Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Michael Orr of Memphis was a giant of a boy and a lost soul. 6'5", 330 pounds, a tested IQ of 80. 11 schools by the time he hit his teens, poor, black, and huge. Then, in a head-turning twist, Michael Orr was taken in and legally adopted by a rich, white, evangelical family in the Memphis suburbs and turned into a high school graduate, a college student, and a big-time football phenomenon headed for the limelight and riches of the NFL. Now, big-time sports watcher Michael Lewis is telling a provocative story of poverty, love, and glory at the intersection of God, race, and football. Up next on Point, author Michael Lewis and the rags-to-gridiron story of Michael Orr. Joining me now from Seattle is author Michael Lewis. His best-selling books include Liar's Poker, The New Thing, and Moneyball, The Art of Winning an Unfair Game. He's a regular contributor to the New York Times Magazine. His most recent article, The Ballad of Big Mike, comes from his new book, The Blind Side, Evolution of a Game. Michael Lewis, thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
You've got two big currents at work here. One is a kind of arc of evolution in the game of football, and the other is the life of Michael Orr. I wish you'd begin to introduce us to each of those.
Well, why don't I start with the subplot, the evolution of the game of football. Mm-hmm. What interested me was after I finished with Moneyball, I took an interest in how NFL teams were distributing their dollars that they had, because they all have the same number of dollars to spend on players. Mm-hmm. And I was curious if there was a science or even a pseudoscience to how you know how much you paid a quarterback versus a wide receiver versus a center and so on and so forth. And discovered in the course of this that, oddly, the left tackle position on the offensive line had gotten to be the second highest paid on the field.
Right after the quarterback and way ahead of everybody else.
What was so odd about this is this is a totally obscure person on the field. I mean, nobody sees him. Nobody knows who he is. The camera's never on him. He never touches the ball. There's no glamour, and his job is thought to be mundane. And 15 years ago, he was the lowest paid person on the field. So something had happened in the game to increase his value. Now, while I was stewing on this problem, mm-hmm. I ran across this boy in Memphis, Michael Orr, around whom there was a frenzy of interest from college recruiters. He was the most highly recruited offensive lineman in the nation because he had been identified as just this beast, the guy who could play the left tackle position, and he was regarded as a prodigy at the position. And so the two stories converge, because what the blind side is really about is about the changing value of Michael Orr and how he goes from being at the age of 15 a boy with an IQ of 80 who has essentially no schooling and can't read or write and who has basically raised himself in inner city Memphis on the streets, often with not enough to eat, no medical care whatsoever, no nurture whatsoever, and is headed for a very bad end. He's about to drop out of school. And through a series of flukes, he ends up at the Briarcrest Christian School, at 20 miles away from inner city Memphis in the rich white suburbs, and is taken in by a wealthy white evangelical Christian family. And in a period of a couple of years, he goes from being one of society's least valued members to one of the most valuable 18-year-olds on the planet. The evolution of the position he played was part of that. I mean, part of the reason he became so valuable is the position he played on the football field had become so valuable.
Now, that position became so valuable because of a kind of line of evolution that you trace back to Lawrence Taylor on the New York Giants in the early 1980s, when the sack became the big play in the NFL. This powerful defensive player who would blast through that offensive line and get at the blind side of the quarterback. Describe the dynamic that went to work with Lawrence Taylor there.
Well, the the left tackle is assigned to block whatever is coming off the right side of the defensive line, which is the blind side of the quarterback, of the right-handed quarterback. He can't see what's coming from there. And Lawrence Taylor, who was a great linebacker for the New York Giants, transformed that position, attacking the quarterback from that side. And, you know, what was interesting is I talked to Lawrence Taylor and a number of people who played with him and against him is you saw he introduced at a kind of a whole new level fear on a football field. Quarterbacks would come to the line of scrimmage and they'd be looking across the line and all they cared about was where was Lawrence Taylor, and they had to see him before they'd take the snap, and they'd
because
forget
this,
their snap.
This was not a gentle takedown that he would bring to them if he could.
No, he so routinely hurt quarterbacks and put them out of games that that before the New York Giants would play a team, the defense would meet and decide whether it was to their advantage or not for Lawrence to hurt the quarterback, because in some cases the second string quarterback was better than the first string quarterback, and so they'd say in this game, Lawrence, try not to hurt him because we want him in there. But no, it was not a gentle takedown, and you had quarterbacks calling timeout because they couldn't find Lawrence Taylor across the line of scrimmage, only to find that Lawrence Taylor was on the sidelines, out of the play altogether. There was a real fear he introduced to the game, and not only him, he created a type that since Lawrence Taylor came into the league, there have been a number of players who come in and there with the express desire to sort of be Lawrence Taylor, and there needed to be some response to this on the other side of the line of scrimmage. The way you typically dealt with that pass rusher was putting a running back on him or putting a tight end on him to block him. And running backs were getting hurt trying to block him. They couldn't do it anyway. So what emerged was this preternaturally gifted, huge lineman.
The NFL and others went looking for Giants to stop exactly that rush.
But not just Giants. Giants who are fast, because they have to be quick enough to keep up with Lawrence Taylor. So it's a very odd combination of... And not just size, height. It's height, weight. You know, 6'5" or high or taller, 320 or heavier. A quickness. You're typically by far the quickest quickest lineman on the line, and sometimes quicker than the running back behind him. And arm length and hand size, and there are all these specifications in the character who's needed to stop the Lawrence Taylor character. And so he's a very rare beast.
So there we are at the kind of the top of our sports entertainment food chain, among the highest football players in the land, our bread and circus, our football gladiators, suddenly have a need for a certain kind of individual. And that need, all the way up there in the bright lights of professional football, filters down to this very young man in Memphis who had just about as rough an upbringing as you can possibly imagine. But as you describe it, there was nothing inevitable about him being found, picked up, sort of lifted up by this family that did exactly that, a family that you knew from an old childhood friendship.
That's right. There was nothing inevitable about it. This was a boy who had been... he just finished his ninth grade. Michael Orr had just finished his ninth grade year in public school. He had been to 11 different schools at that point, had been out of school for stretches of 18 months on end. He was about to drop out of school, and he didn't have any place to sleep at nights. His mother had a crack addiction. His father was not around at all. He was one of 13 children who just was not cared for, and he ended up on the floor of a man who lived in inner city Memphis, named Tony Henderson. Everyone knew him as Big Tony because he weighed 400 pounds. But Big Tony had a son who was Michael Orr's age, and they had become friends, and they let Michael Orr crash on his floor for a couple of months. And in those couple of months, Big Tony's mother died, and Big Tony's mother was a born-again Christian. And she said to Big Tony as her dying wish, I want my grandson to have a Christian education. And so Big Tony packed his kid in a car along with Big Mike, because he happened to be sleeping on the floor, and took him out to go find a Christian school. And so it was very accidental. And then a series of accidents enables the kid to stay in the school, because, of course, when Big Mike gets to a well-to-do private school, he's completely unqualified for it. He can't function at all. The teachers at the school, when they first encountered him, said it was they had read the story of the boy who had been locked in a closet for the first 10 or 12 years of his life. They said he was just like that boy. He had no ability to communicate. He was almost mute. He had no ability to absorb anything in the classroom. No one knew he was an athlete. They knew he was huge. But they didn't know he could actually do anything.
But he ended up more than just at the school. He ends up legally adopted by this family, the family of Sean and Leanne Tui. You knew Sean Tui from your own childhood. He'd done pretty well with a chain of fast food restaurants and now took this young man into his family, and not just into the family, but adopted him.
Well, this was interesting. You know, all my books have been the result of accidents. I didn't plan them in a funny way. And this was another case. I had been stewing on this left tackle thing. And I was traveling through Memphis a couple of 2.5 years ago to give a talk. And writing something about my high school baseball coach at the same time. And I thought, I should call Sean Tui just to see if he has anything to say about it, even though we hadn't spoken in 25 years. And I went over to his house, and there Michael Orr was sitting in the living room, and it was a shocking sight. And I got very interested in this story. But what happened was, Sean Tui had a child who was in Michael Orr's class at the Briarcrest Christian School, a daughter. And she told him, she said, there's this new kid in school, and he doesn't talk to anybody, and everybody's terrified of him. And when he comes up the stairwell, everybody has to turn around and go back the other way because you can't fit by him. And Sean was over at the school one day, and he saw the kid sitting around. And he knew, because Sean had been, interestingly, he himself had been a poor boy at a rich school.
The author, as a beast, animal imagery, meat imagery, and, you know, I'm not a football fan. I only read baseball reporting, basically.
Okay.
And I don't know if that's common to use the language of the slave, you know, market still to refer to African-American athletes.
So on the one hand, he's picked up and taken someplace he never would have been, very likely. But at the same time, Rebecca, there's kind of some current in this that was bugging you.
Well, absolutely. And the other thing is, I never could figure out if the young man actually ever learned how to read, or if they, you know, they treated him as a special ed student and he did all of his work verbally, that's cool. But I feel like it sort of tap danced around. And I think it's an issue.
Let us pick both those up, if we may, Rebecca. And thanks for your call, Michael Lewis. And we'll hear in a moment from Leanne Tui,
right,
the adoptive mother of Michael Orr, get her take on this. But you hear Rebecca's questions here. You know, on the one hand, how fantastic. This kid was, you know, freezing, wearing shorts in winter, not getting enough food. A family takes him in. Now he's in college and maybe on the way to a big NFL paycheck. At the same time, you know, you said it yourself, it was just this beast they were looking for. And that brings to mind some old imagery.
Well, beast, creature. I wasn't talking about the boy as a beast. And that is, in fact, how football people talk about these characters. So it has nothing to do with him being black. It's how football people talk about the creatures on the field. And they actually regard it as flattering, white and black. So the boy is not dehumanized in the story, and is not, in fact, just the opposite. He's loved for who he is by this family. And they kind of bring him back to life in some strange way. Part of bringing him back to life is, in fact, teaching him how to function, not just on the field but off. And he does learn how to read. I'm not sure he'll ever read with pleasure. There's something about learning how to read at the age of 16 and 17. It's different from learning how to read when you're 5 or 6. I mean, that he basically reads by having memorized huge numbers of words. He was never taught phonics. And so he can read, and he can write. Writes rather well, actually. But yes, all that happened. And he was before he became a football player, he had, at this Christian school, he had to be able to function in the classroom. They didn't let him into the athletic programs until after he had proven that he could function in the classroom. And the only way that happens is the intervention of the Tui family.
We're going to hear in just a second from Leanne Tui, the mother there. You include a little excerpt from an essay that Michael Orr wrote here. I mean, it reminds us how issues of identity and race don't go away when you move into a new situation like this. He wrote an essay called White Walls, and it began, as you quoted, "I look and I see white everywhere, white walls, white floors, and a lot of white people. The teachers are not aware that I have no idea of anything they're talking about. I do not want to listen to anyone, especially the teachers. They are giving homework and expecting me to do the problems on my own. I've never done homework in my life. I go to the bathroom, look in the mirror, and say, this is not Mike Orr. I want to get out of this place." But he didn't, and he's gone a far piece since that essay. We're joined right now from Memphis, Tennessee, by the mom in the couple that adopted Michael Orr. Leanne Toohey's with us. She and her husband, Sean, took Michael Orr into their home, into their family. Leanne Toohey, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You did a very intimate thing in bringing a new young person into your family, and now it's very public through Michael Orr's success and this book. How do you feel about having this whole story out in the glare of so much public attention, Leanne?
Well, that changes hourly. this was something that, you know, we never imagined that it would come to this when Michael came to live with us, but it has, and it's just something that we're dealing with, and hopefully if children are helped and lives change through an act of kindness that we did, then it's it'll be a wonderful thing.
Can you take us back to those weeks and maybe months when you became aware of Michael Orr and move from simple awareness to a decision to actually make him part of your family? How did that happen?
You know, I don't ever think that there was a cognitive moment that we said we're doing this. It just kind of happened through attrition. I mean, it was just, you know, we saw him, you know, he needed something, we provided the need, we realized that he was, you know, that the child really didn't have a life. I mean, he had none of the basic creature comforts of being fed, clothed, and loved. And not that he had, you know, had not experienced love in his life, because, I mean, I think he had. I mean, he had some siblings that he was, mm-hmm. a few siblings that he was somewhat close to. But, you know, just one thing led to another. We didn't say, we're going to do this. It just slowly evolved. And then all of a sudden, he was here, and he was a permanent fixture. And, it just happened. I mean, we didn't look at him one morning and say, we were going to take him into our home, and we're going to adopt him and take care of him. It was never a moment like that.
You know, your husband, of course, had a pretty big sports background himself and remained very interested in football. Do you think this would have happened if Michael Orr wasn't such a great potential football player? Was part of your motivation that you, like maybe some talent scouts, saw a future NFL star in this boy?
Never entered my mind. We never entered. When we met Michael, he didn't even play football. I mean, I have letters that my husband sent to coaches that coached him in college that were at small D2 basketball colleges saying, look, I've got a child. You know, I think I can teach him some basketball skills. I want to make sure that he, is educated and can provide for himself in the world. And I really want to send you some tape on him and look at the potential. You to give him a basketball scholarship to your, you know, school. And, I mean, these were small schools in Florida. And, I mean, these were schools, you know, most people are not even familiar with. So, I mean, I mean, we never set out thinking that he would be. We were actually stunned that he had the ability to play football like he plays.
Of course, you know, there have been this accusation or allegation, oh, this family picked this kid up because they wanted to send a great talent to Ole Miss, the alma mater, and bring glory on the school and themselves and all the rest. What do you say in response to that?
You know, I learned a long time ago people are going to say what they want to say, mm-hmm. and you can't defend yourself, and it is what it is. I mean, everybody can take their pot shot. It doesn't bother us. Michael is a changed child. I love him. He thinks I birthed him. It's fine. People can say whatever they want to say. I look at myself in the mirror every day, and I know that we did the right thing. So I'm very pleased with our decision, and he is as much a member of this family as my other two children are.
Let me take a call from Providence, Rhode Island. Nathan's on the line. Hi, Nathan. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
We're well. What do you think of the story, Nathan?
I think it's amazing. I think it's just another story that goes to show you that real things in life happen that you could never even imagine. If I had picked this book up and never heard this program, I never would have guessed that this was a real life story. I mean, this is truly amazing, and I applaud the people, the family that brought this young man into their home. You know, it could have been a life that might have gone to waste, and football or not, this sounds like a very amazing young man.
Nathan, thanks for your call. Michael Lewis, as you look across this whole story, what were the odds of this happening?
Infinitesimal. This is the bigger point about the story is that you have wandering around inner city Memphis a boy at age 15, 6 foot 5 inches, almost 350 pounds, who can run like a deer, who has obvious physical gifts that are of use and value to the world, and even he goes neglected, and that it took this series of incredible accidents for his value and his gifts to be appreciated. It makes you wonder what's left inside inner city Memphis and inner city America that goes completely unappreciated because it's not so obvious. I mean, there's hardly a more obvious, you don't think, when you think of the problems of inner city America, you don't think it has a problem getting its athletes out into the world. But even its athletes don't get out into the world. So what happens to its violinists and its doctors and its lawyers and so on and so forth? I mean, it's because it's so flukish that it resonates. Because it's so flukish, it tells you so much about the life that really was more likely to be available to Michael Orr.
Leon Tui, how do you think about all those other kids? I mean, Michael stood out because of his physical dimensions and speed. But what about the chess club members on the wrong side of the tracks in Memphis, or kids who aren't stars but don't deserve nothing either? Is there a way to extend the kind of example of what you've done here to those kids, or is this only for potential NFL stars?
Oh no, absolutely not. I mean, we've seen handicapped children in wheelchairs and have helped them. I mean, honestly, that's the truth. My cheerleading partner in college had a horrific accident right before a basketball game, and he is quadriplegic. And, we get involved with his calls all the time. I mean, Michael just happened to be an athlete. And, you know, I'm just as concerned with the child. Now, Sean has a passion for athletes.
Your husband, Sean, yeah.
Yes, because he thinks that there's so many kids that they tend to be a group that get passed along a little bit quicker through school and don't learn to read and write and don't know what a protractor is, and they're slighted with their education because they are athletic, and then they get to this roadblock to try to get into college, and if they haven't been, you know, don't meet the academic requirements, then it's, well, too bad for you. Whereas somebody that's gifted, a gifted musician or a mathematician or, you know, a child like that, they're having the academics. They usually tend to, you know, the cream rises to the top, and even though they're financially maybe not as stable as another child, they get the academic breaks. They get the scholarship. So, I mean, no, we're not necessarily, I mean, this didn't set out to be an athletic choice because of Michael's size and everything. It just, that kind of happened. But, any child that needs help, I mean, you know, we need to help any child that needs it, not just because of their athletic ability. But
Michael Lewis, it was pretty early on that Michael Orr got spotted for his physical size and his speed. I mean, it didn't go unnoticed forever by any means.
Well, you know, it's interesting because he gets to this school and none of the teachers think he should be there. And it takes them a while to figure out that his brain actually does function. But the coaches all see him. I mean, obviously, this kid is walking around. As the football coach said, I didn't know if he could play, but we didn't have anybody who looked like him around here. And they start kind of keeping an eye on him. And the basketball coach saw him walking across a basketball court one day and threw a basketball at him, see what he'd do. Mm. And, you know, you imagine the shape of this boy. He's six inches shorter than Shaquille O'Neal and 30 pounds heavier. So that's how wide he is. Mm. You think he's going to kind of go under the basket and stuff it. And he dribbles instead. He dribbles it between his legs three times and twirls out to the three-point line, hits a three-point shot. And the coach goes, oh, my God, Did I just see that body do that? I can't believe he was able to do that.
And you had Clemson coaches and other in a big-time football scouts saying, watching him for a couple of minutes and saying, full ride for you, young man, if you want it.
That's right. Well, you know, but this is but it didn't happen quite like that. Mm-hmm. What happened was they played him his junior year on the Briarcrest team, and the coaches actually didn't think he was that good. They benched him for parts of games because they played him on defense partly, he just didn't know what he was supposed to do. So they were under the illusion that he was not very good in football. And what happens is a football scout sees his tape and they see the combination of size and speed. They know that if he's used right and trained right, that he can be something. They see the potential. But this was not something that was seen at the level of his high school. It was seen first by a football scout who then broadcasts it to college coaches who then show up and say, oh, my goodness, he's right. This is an incredible combination of physical gifts.
Leon Tuohy, speak to us, if you would, about the race piece of this. You're fairly open with Michael Lewis about having grown up in a fairly racist household, your father. Here you were then years later adopting an African-American young man. How did your friends and neighbors respond to that? And was it part of your, you know, bedtime conversation with Sean? Can we do this across racial lines?
You know, once again, that was never really, that wasn't an issue. I mean, we never, until Michael, you know, broached that question to me, I hadn't thought of it in that context. More than anything being race, some people questioned, and I'm sure a lot of people questioned, but it was literally brought to our attention by some, the fact that, you know, we had a 16-year-old daughter and we were bringing a 16-year-old male into the house. Mm-hmm. That might have been more the issue than race. My father was, he was military, retired military. He was a policeman. He was a U.S. Marshal. He grew up in a different era than Sean and I did, and you know, he had certainly different views than we did on racism, but you know, my father's deceased, and I really couldn't even guess how he would have handled this. Everyone else in my family has accepted Michael with open arms. So, you know, we never, you know, not many people, I'm sure people thought it, and they'll continue to think it, but we never had an issue with the race situation. It was probably more that, you know, we were bringing a male into the house. It was the same age as our daughter.
Leanne Tuohy, she and her husband Sean took Michael Orr into their home. Eric is calling from Orangeburg, South Carolina. Hi, Eric. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, Geoff.
Hi.
I just wanted to tell you guys, do not let people tell you that, you know, in other words, you picked someone who you thought was athletically talented, because I felt when I was younger I was a highly athletically talented person, because mm-hmm. one of my friends made it to pro football, and another friend of mine was invited to the Cowboys camp, and the one that made it to pro football admitted that he was just as fast as the one even though he was invited to camp, he took a corporate job. But both of them admit that I was a highly talented athlete. Speed wise, I could have made it, but academically, I was behind as a child.
Eric, what do you think of this family, white family, who took on an African American young man? What do you think of their much more than a gesture here? What they did?
Well, I my hat's off to them. If anyone can promote anyone, because when you're behind academically, and let's say you drop out of school, then that talent will never show. See, I'm even to the point, I even think that there should be some kind of league for people who aren't prepared for sports. If they have the potential talent, I don't think academics is too tied in with it. But even though, yes, you do need those life skills, because I was behind. I had a sugar condition I was born with, and it affects me to this day.
And there was nobody to throw you that lifeline to get you over that hurdle. Maybe there ought to be a way to go.
Well, believe it or not, see, my mother started the health center in the place we live in. My mother had a middle-class job at that time, And but she was academically oriented. See, my brother's an anesthesiologist.
So you got a lot going on in the family, but you couldn't climb that athletic ladder on its own.
No, see the academics. See the academics. I was behind. See my sugar swings were so bad that it caused me to fall behind academically.
Yep.
So as a result, when I was in that, I went to a little private school for kids with learning disabilities in the eighth grade. And then after that, I went to another private school that didn't even have a basketball or a football team, and I never got to express my, you know, athletic dream.
Right.
But I wanted to succeed academically. That was my mother's dream because she started a health center, and my brother attended Morehouse College.
Wow. So it worked on some sides. We hear the complexity in that story, Eric, and your thumbs up for the Tuohy family, in Michael Orr's case here, thanks for that. Michael Lewis, how did the family get Big Mike, Michael Orr, up on the beam academically? What did that take after all those years of bouncing from school to school?
Well, they drowned him in nurture. They themselves, Leanne and Sean Tuohy, were not bookish people, and the idea of sitting up all night reading Pilgrim's Progress aloud to him was not their idea of fun. But that's what they started by doing that, by taking him through the assignments themselves until they were bleary-eyed. And then they brought on a phalanx of tutors to come and meet him after school. And I watched this process. I mean, he'd come home from having an overpacked day at school to make up for what he had not had in his in his early childhood, and he'd have five more hours of tutoring at home. So that's the kind of thing they did, and it resulted in, I mean, it's incredible what happened to him. Not only did he learn to read and write, not only did he end up making the Briarcrest Honor Roll every quarter his senior year, his IQ jumps 20 to 30 points. And that's not supposed to happen, but it just shows you that two things, that IQ, there's probably a nurture component to IQ. It isn't this fixed quantity. And two, that if you're in a bad inner city public school system, people are looking to mark you down as dumb so it can justify the poor results you attain in school. But the psychologist who tested him for learning disabilities after he had been inside the Tuohy's house for almost 2 years, and as I say, drowned in nurture and tutoring, said that it was that the mind that she was evaluating was like a different human being than the mind reflected in the tests that he had been given when he was in the Memphis public school system.
I do have to ask you about what you call the Great Mormon Grade Giveaway,
yeah,
required
right.
at the end of this to get him actually over the hump, to get the grade average required to go on to college football. I didn't know such a thing existed, a kind of a grade mill where you could just pump out A's essentially and somehow back add them onto your high school record. How'd that work for him?
It was the Great Mormon Grade Grab. You got to get that right.
Okay.
All right. His Great Mormon Grade. And this is, well, look, this is what happened. He had essentially all F's on his transcript until he arrives at the Briarcrest Christian School. Then he has all D's from then until the Tuohy's seize hold of him. And then he has all A's and B's.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of his high school career, he has to present himself to the NCAA for certification. And they take their ACT score, the kid's ACT score, and they say, given that ACT score, you have to have this grade point average to qualify to play. And his grade point average was a little too low, and cumulative grade point average. Mm. And so there are, you know, the NCAA are the Keystone Cops in all this, that they set up barriers to prevent kids who haven't received a proper education from going to college to play football or basketball, to maintain supposedly the purity of the collegiate of the student athlete experience, but at the same time there are these very complicated rules about what you can and can't do to rejigger that grade point.
So how do you turn the water into wine, the F's into
A's?
How's that work?
BYU, and these are, I think, about
Brigham Young
outlawed.
University. Yep.
Right. Brigham Young University offered correspondence courses, and you could take them on the internet. They were proctored, but you would get a course, and it would take 10 days for them to do the reading. And at the end of 10 days, he could take a test on the internet, and the grade from that course could be used to replace the grade from an entire quarter.
10 days, and boom, there it is.
Boom, that's right. And so, but this, to me, this is how I felt about it. Yes, it's scandalous, right? It is scandalous that you can replace a high school transcript in a matter of a few months, or at least a year on a high school transcript. But having said that, I felt like here I was watching a boy who had gone from a world in which everything was rigged against him to a world where everything was rigged for him. And I didn't mind so much that they were that they were allowed to sort of make up for lost time.
A kind of cosmic balancing of the scales.
There was a kind of balancing of the scales, and the spirit of it was very interesting. The spirit of the thing, while totally cynical, Sean Tuohy was a master at figuring out how to work the system, and he worked the system to the kid's advantage. While totally cynical, the kid was nevertheless having some passionate experiences with learning. With this course, I couldn't deny it. I watched them do it. That they would read The Charge of the Light Brigade, and for the first time, the kid heard a poem that he actually liked, and he wanted to memorize the poem. And so it wasn't a totally bogus experience. However, it probably shouldn't exist.
There's also a moment, there was another kind of learning that went on here. Despite his enormous size, Michael Orr was not an aggressive kid, even on the football field. And then there comes a point you describe in the book where the Tuohy family, Leanne Tuohy and the others are at a game, an evening when Michael Orr kind of turns the corner and begins to show the kind of aggression that, of course, will have to go along with his size to make him into that player that all the coaches are so excited about eventually seeing. We should read a little bit for us from The Blind Side, Michael Lewis. Set it up and read that remarkable moment of the sort of making of a football player out of Michael Orr.
Well, it's the first game of his senior year, and across the line of scrimmage from him is a player who has been insulting him for the first quarter of the game, calling him basically a fat kid. Mm-hmm. And this is the last time in Michael Orr's career where his reputation doesn't precede him. He's about to be famous, but he isn't famous yet. And the kid on the other team clearly looked at him and thought, oh, that's the tuba player in the band who they just stuck on the line of scrimmage because they didn't have anybody else. He didn't understand that this kid across from him was really a strange and unusual athlete. And so So the coach of the Briarcrest football team calls a play that requires Michael to block the person who's been insulting him for calling him a fat boy for the first quarter and a half. And Leanne Tuohy is in the stands, as she is for all the games. And she had been kind of noticing that Michael seemed to be getting irritated on the field. She said she could tell by his body language he was getting tense, but she didn't think anything of it. And then she gets up to go get a hot dog, I think. But here's the passage. Leanne rose from her seat to beat the crowd to the concession stand, and so had her back to the action when the people in the stands around her began to laugh. "Where is he taking him?" she heard someone say. "He's not letting go of that kid," someone else shouted. She turned around in time to see 20 football players running down one side of the field after the Briarcrest running back with the ball. On the other side of the field, Briarcrest number 74, Michael Orr, was racing at speed in the opposite direction, with the defensive end in his arms. From his place on the sideline, Sean watched in amazement. Hugh had called a running play around the right end, away from Michael's side. Michael's job was simply to take the kid who had been jabbering at him and wall him off, just keep him away from the ball carrier. Instead, he'd fired off the line of scrimmage and gotten fit. Once he had his hands inside the Mumford player's shoulder pads, he lifted him off the ground. It was a perfectly legal block with unusual consequences. He drove the Mumford player straight down the field for 15 yards, then took a hard left towards the Mumford sidelines. The Mumford kid's feet were hitting the ground every four steps like a cartoon character, said Sean. As the kid strained to get his feet back on the ground, Michael ran him the next 25 or so yards to the Mumford bench. When he got there, he didn't stop, but piled right through it, knocking over the bench, several more Mumford players, and scattering the team. He didn't skip a beat. Encircling the football field was a cinder track. He blocked the kid across the 10-yard wide track and then across the grass on the other side of the cinder track. That's where Sean lost sight of him.
Michael Orr ultimately saying he intended to put that loudmouth opponent right back on the
bus.
That's
right. The bus is on the other side of the fence. And when Michael comes to back to the line, Sean's chewing him out for doing it. And he says, where were you taking him? And Michael says, I was going to put him on the bus. And he sees the bus is 100 yards away. And Michael said it was time for that boy to go home.
The aggression trigger is hit there, and along with the size and the nurture. And suddenly you've got the headed for pro football package. Irwin's calling from Natick, Massachusetts. Hi, Irwin. You're on the air.
Hi, Michael.
Yes.
Michael, hi. It's very good to speak to you because I read your book, Billy, and I just finished Blindside, and I was on my way to the post office this morning to mail it to a friend of mine in New Orleans who has to read it, and I have two questions for you. The first question is, at the end of the book, it seemed as if you kind of let in, and I was wondering if this is what you intended, let in on the fact that perhaps Michael, for the first year or two at school, was just laying low because he seemed to be very streetwise at the end of the book as you relate his youth. It seemed as if he was very, very streetwise, but yet he knew when to keep his mouth shut and his eyes open.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps for the first 2 years with the Tuies, he just laid low because he just didn't know what was going to happen next. That's my first question. The second question is, you really have a talent, and I admire this, for finding what I say are undervalued and highly talented things. And my son was a student at Tulane. His freshman roommate was an Isidore Newman kid. So I built up a little bit of networking with some Isidore Newman people.
That was Michael Lewis's high school and Sean Tuies as well. And your question out of that, Irwin?
Well, I've sent it down to a friend of yours who's in New Orleans. I'm sending this book to a fellow that knows you, and I had this fellow's son on my, I have a collegiate wood bat baseball team in Holyoke, Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a place where undervalued kids with a lot of talent come in order to be developed for Major League Baseball, and I was wondering if you had done any research into that or if that's on your radar screen. And
Irwin, we got it. Our time is short. What about it, Michael Lewis? A savvy kid for those 2 years, just laying low, ready to step out as a big Ole Miss player on his way to the NFL?
It's too long to describe the incident, but there's an incident that occurs when he gets to Ole Miss that causes Leanne and Sean Tuies briefly to wonder whether he had been playing them all along.
He explodes at another football player, really knocks him around. After that player insults the Tuies.
And then vanishes. But then he vanishes.
Takes off.
And the thing is that Michael, it's clear to nobody that he's bright when he arrives at the Briarcrest Christian School. It becomes clearer and clearer that he actually, his brain not only works, it works in kind of interesting ways. And he does gain all this confidence. And the reader is left. He's right. I left it open the possibility that he was actually the protagonist in all this. That he was he was running this whole show all along. At the same time, it seems that he's being manipulated by others. He allowed other people to manipulate him. And I think there's some truth to that interpretation. He is actually at bottom a rather willful person. And if you think about it, it takes a rather extraordinary person to have experienced the journey that he has and come out so well of it.
Is he destined to be in the NFL and a star there? Is it baked in the cake?
If he doesn't get hurt, Nick Saban, who's the head coach of the Miami Dolphins, is already telling people he's waiting to draft him at the end of his junior year. He's the starting left tackle at Ole Miss and a sophomore right now. And you just don't find. He's now 6'6", 330 pounds, and they're very lean 330 pounds, and very, very gifted. So, yes, if he doesn't get hurt, he'll be there.
Michael Lewis, the new book is The Blind Side, Evolution of a Game. Michael Lewis, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.